Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today, my thoughts on deliberate practice and expertise. Before we go into that, we've lost a true lion of emergency medicine. Bob Weirs, easily one of the smartest people in our specialty, has died. He will be missed. This episode is dedicated to him. If you don't know who Bob Weirs is, then you should read the wonderful obituary that was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine. It's linked in the show notes at mcrit.org/212. So last episode was Anders Ericsson discussing his book Peak and all of the science behind it. And a lot came out of that interview, and even more actually doing it in person. It made me think, and I want to just record some of my thoughts here for all of you on the 10,000 hour rule. Let's think about that. The 10,000 hours, which was debunked, it's probably closer to 20 or 30,000, at least in the field of professional level violin. And who knows what the real number is for other things like the specialty of medicine or the subspecialties of medicine. But 10,000 is just to get you in the door. It was at the start of professional level training at a famous school of violin. 10,000 hours of deliberate practice was put in by these violinists. So that's just the entry. But that was deliberate practice. And Dr. Ericsson really spent a lot of time pointing out that that's not just playing the violin for fun. That's not giving concerts to your family. That's sitting down and sweating the micro skills of violin with a coach actually giving you assignments to improve. That's what those 10,000 hours consist of, and anything else, just kind of noodling around on the strings, didn't fit into that. He gave the perfect example that driving a car for 10,000 hours, which, you know, eventually many of us will do, doesn't make you an expert driver. That when it comes to driving a car, we probably do 0 hours of deliberate practice, and very few of us, aside from our dad or mom teaching us to drive when we were 16 or 17 years old, we never really had a coach. And even if we did have those couple of months, they weren't expert coaches, and they never taught us the right way. Probably very few of us are expert drivers unless we've sought out individualized attention at a driving school and then practiced those specific skills for hours at a time. Well, it's the same situation in medicine. How many hours of deliberate practice have we put in? Probably zero. 0 hours of deliberate practice, because we don't meet the criteria of having an expert coach giving us assignments based on our current level of performance. How many hours of purposeful practice do we do? Well, I'm sure there's a few. Every so often, you'll be given a task in your residency training that actually embodies the necessities of purposeful practice, but not many. Certainly not 10,000 hours worth. Certainly not 20, 30, 40,000 hours worth. That's a little bit troubling, because while beautiful music coming from a violin is important, I would argue not nearly as important as taking care of patients and potentially saving their lives. And yet we do a less regimented, a less rigorous, a less scientifically based approach to our training and knowledge acquisition than these violinists. So how do we fix this? Well, I think the easiest, the lowest hanging fruit would be procedures. And so I've tried to counter this in two ways. I've asked the fellows I train in resuscitation to film themselves doing procedures. And since this is only for quality assurance, and since I have them verbally consent the patients, I think this is okay without any like real huge amounts of photo release or whatsoever, because these clips get deleted, they're not shown anywhere, they're not used for anything except for quality assurance. But you know, obviously go with your hospital's policy. But this allows us to actually see the procedures and coach the fellows on what they're doing. And it also leads to a very important realization, which is things take much longer than you think they do, unless you have some objective measure of how long they take. If you're not going to film your procedures, I certainly, and this is a sidebar, this is a tangent, I'm sorry, but I certainly recommend you look at the time going into the procedure and then coming out, so you could realize that what you thought took 5 minutes actually took a half hour. But again, tangential. But allowing them to film allows them to be coached. And then the other thing I've really worked towards is the micro skill breakdown of procedures, because then you could train the individual micro skills. And central line Seldinger technique is one I've worked on MCRIT a bunch. And if you could break down the technique of central line placement into its individual micro skills, then you could realize which micro skills are failing. Oh, I don't know how to one-hand tie. Oh, I'm really not so good at the transition from the syringe needle to taking that syringe off and putting a wire in. And you could actually get some purposeful practice, or if you want to be watched by someone who knows what they're doing, you get deliberate practice out of this, and you could put in a few hours of that. It's so funny. 1 hour of deliberate practice on any of these micro skills will make you better than almost anyone else around you, which just proves the point I've been attempting to make, which is we do virtually no deliberate practice because it's so easy to get good by even putting, like if you put in 3 hours on the micro skills of central line placement, you would be a monster. You would be amazing because no one does it. I mean, I still graduate residents at both of the programs I've trained residents at where they can't one-hand tie. Now, one-hand ties requires a little dexterity, but it is a skill you could easily be a master of with 4 or 5 hours of deliberate practice. And you don't do it all at once. Dr. Erickson was very clear on this. I mean, you do maybe 15 minutes a day of deliberate practice, and you just let that build over a couple of weeks. And all of a sudden, you're really good at that skill. So why is purposeful practice, much less deliberate practice, so tough to get in emergency medicine and critical care? Well, first of all, we have very few expert teachers, by which I mean not experts who are teaching. We have those, but people expert at teaching the actual things they're teaching. And we don't have this pathway to deliberate practice that Erickson discusses as a requisite for true deliberate practice. And then the other thing is that very little in our job gives us feedback. And therefore, we are constantly performing, possibly correctly and possibly not, and we have no way to discern the difference. And people could go years thinking they're doing great. And then if someone who was an expert teacher watched them, they say, no, you've been doing it wrong all along. On mental representations and mental models. Gosh, I love this part of the interview. It fits in with so much of the other stuff that interests me, like OODA loops, like Gary Klein talking about how we actually approach real system one thinking in a successful manner as opposed to the failed heuristics discussed in books like Thinking Fast and Slow. These building of mental models are how we become expert. And one comment he makes has continued to stick with me, which is experts are almost defined by having a very good memory, a very accurate memory, a very utile memory of what took place in any individual performance state, any individual encounter. An expert can be known as an expert by their ability to second by second relay accurately what happened in a resuscitation, while a non-expert, because they don't have the ability to see through the enhancing focus of a mental model, can't relay it very well. They relay in generalities as opposed to specifics, and their memories are often false. And this leads to very frustrating circumstances, especially when you've had a conflict with a resident from another service. And if you are an expert and they are not, they will have a very colored vision of what actually took place, mostly motivated by a desire of ego preservation and a desire to not be in a state of proving to themselves their own inadequacy. This has been studied in the cognitive psych literature extensively, and you could see my Rhesus Wankers talk if you want to hear more about this. The other mark of an expert is the capability of verbalizing their thinking behind the choices they made. And then you could actually have them relay their mental model, and there's such an economy of expression. I think this is best expressed by a example of a patient with shortness of breath. And this exact example was crystallized by Andy Neal in the interview that he had conducted on the book Peak. He and I both came to the same example because it's just so crystal clear. That patient with shortness of breath who the beginner, the novice, looks at and says, oh, the patient's short of breath and they're breathing at 40. And then someone a little bit more developed may say, wow, this patient is sick and I'm worried about them and I really need to act soon. They've now gone to that extra step of identifying that this is more a problematic patient than the one who has a very mild asthma exacerbation. And then the expert takes one look at that patient and just says, well, this is obviously sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema. And it requires nothing more than that glance to make that, because their mental model is so developed. They've picked up on the patient's body habitus, their facial, the sound of their breathing, the actual pulse ox waveform, their tachycardia and hypertension. And they made an instant diagnosis that this is CHF mediated by increased afterload. And the mental models just lead to such a startling quickness to being able to process huge amounts of information that chess player looks at the board and they just process it all as a whole, because it's pattern matched and idea matched to things they've experienced before. And if you just move three of those pieces and now it's not any longer a logical pattern, they're not going to be able to remember what those pieces look like, because they're not photographically memorizing the entire board. They're memorizing a mental model of the board. Now, this concept was writ real by a book called Surgical Scripts by Abernathy and Ham. And what this book was an attempt by a clinical surgeon and a cognitive psychologist to analyze the approach of various levels in surgical training on patient problems. Now, I think in some ways the book was failed, because looking at it as an armchair amateur cognitive psychologist, and I think a little bit further developed clinician, I think some of the things said by the supposed experts weren't all that smart, and then the cognitive psychologist, who may not have access to what is good clinical judgment or not, made, I think, a little bit of an exaggerated declaration of just how brilliant the experts were that were interviewed in this book. And it's going to really rub you the wrong way if you have any experience in clinical medicine. But the concept, the idea of this, of let's take novices, expose them to a circumstance, let's take senior residents, let's take attendings who have been out for 20 years and who have been acknowledged as true clinical experts, and let's see how they verbally relay their thought process on various situations. It's a fascinating book. I don't recommend you buy it unless you're in the surgical specialty. I recommend you get it from the library and just take a look. And they had a second book that delved even further into this. It's fascinating stuff. And this ties into our next topic on shadowboxing. But Gary Klein and Dr. Erickson, in different titles, mention this concept of shadowboxing, which is the way to develop non-procedural skills is to videotape a clinical situation, pause at some point, 2 minutes in, what do you think's going on? Is this patient sick or not sick? Is this patient going to need ICU admission or not? What do you think their diagnosis is? Make the learners commit on paper or verbally to what they're thinking, then continue playing and let the scenario roll out a little bit, hear from the experts what they thought at that same stop point, at some point in this exercise, and all of a sudden you've just taken something that may take hundreds of hours to eventually develop the clinical insight, and you've reduced it to deliberate practice. Why are we not doing this? This seems to be relatively easy. This seems to be like something we could do. And I talked in the last episode about a computer program. We don't need a computer program for this. If we could just get permission from patients to videotape a little bit about their presentation. I think one of the true breakthroughs in medicine will be when we just write into hospital policy, and some hospitals may already have this, that we film everything, and then you're allowed to get consent after the fact as to whether you could use it or not for training of other learners. And therefore, you'd never miss out on great stuff. And the understanding is if the patients don't consent for it or you can't get consent, then it just gets burned. It gets erased. It disappears, potentially automatically to make everyone feel happy. But you should be able to film first and consent later, just as now we're doing many clinical trials with retrospective consent. There should be retrospective consent on filming. And then these things like shadowboxing. Wow, you have this great aortic dissection that presented in a subtle way, but not so subtle that it's like, oh, my big toe hurts, and then I turned out to have a dissection. No, they had a dissection, and there were clues. Well, God, folks watching that will benefit all of medicine, and those learners especially. So I think we need to move to that. A thought experiment on objective measurement of expertise. Are experts really experts? Do you know? How do you know? When you're dealing with a consultant from another service, and they've been practicing for 20 years, or one of your colleagues with that same duration of practice, are they an expert? I'm sure they think they are, but are they? They may be. We don't know. See, name badge believers on that Recess Wankers talk. But this is a big problem, because folks either over or underestimate others with no objective backing. Now imagine this. Imagine everything that was a domain in your specialty was mapped out and then measured. How would we go about measuring it? And again, this is just a thought experiment. I'm not advocating that we should actually do this or that we can actually do this, though we probably could. Let's say one of the domains was expertise at laryngoscopy. Well, even with the technology we have right now, we could create a mannequin. We could put on some eye tracking hardware, and we could go in there and intubate the mannequin a few times. The mannequin would change up, you know, make it difficult, easy, make a Cormac-O'Hain 1 and then a 3. And I'm sure with our current generation of computers, you could very quickly come up with an objective measure of expertise just by looking where you're looking, how many times your eyes have to saccade to other places, the actual amount of force you're placing on the laryngoscope and what angle and what vector. All of that could easily be measured, and I guarantee you we could figure out some software to give you a number between 1 and 10 on your skills at laryngoscopy. And let's say that happened in every domain. And now when you're dealing with someone else, you pull up on the hospital files their levels at various things. And, you know, we talked about the procedure one in the setting of intubation laryngoscopy, but, you know, you could also do it with the non-procedural things. How good are they at handling stress in an emergency? What is their, you know, capabilities of immediate diagnosis? Imagine you had numbers for all these. And now, as you're dealing with any individual person, you're like, they're only 3 years into their career in some specialty. But then you look at their ratings and they're all nines. Well, what's going on here? Well, maybe this person had a different career in another country before they came here. Who knows? But are you going to approach that person differently? I bet you would. I bet you would. Are they going to approach you differently if, even though you're an ED doc and they're an anesthesiologist, your skills on laryngoscopy are the same as theirs? Will that lead to a different approach? This would be interesting to see how it would change the dynamics in the hospital. And it's just, this is what Dennett would call an intuition pump. Just see what you think about that idea. I'm super curious to hear in the comments. On mental practice. Mike made a very insightful comment, or it was a question, on is mental practice a way of achieving deliberate practice without actually needing to be in a clinical scenario? Can you develop skills of, for instance, cricothyrotomy just by doing the mental visualization? And we've advocated this. Folks like Cliff Reed has done a very nice diatribe on this. And my answer is, I think yes. But Mike brought up a very good point. And then Dr. Erickson's answer, I think, was very important, which is it's only good if your mental practice is correct. And going back to the Crike example, this is incredibly important, because when I do every year at SMAC the workshop where we teach surgical airway, these folks have been exposed to pre-course videos on how to do it. They've, I'm sure, thought about the procedure. And then when we actually get them, in general, they're doing a very good job. But where they're placing their hands, how they're holding the knife, which part of the scalpel they're cutting with, which angle they're inserting the bougie from, all these things are little changes that being in person and coaching these folks, you notice are not being done perfectly. And then you correct them and they get it. And then I think their mental practice may be much more potent. But I think there's still the potential for infiltration of bad technique to get in there. I think you need that expert coach to reassess make you do it in person on a simulator every 3 months or so, and re-correct you to realign that mental practice. Otherwise, I think if you go 2 years just continuously working only in your head, there's danger that you're going to let errors sneak in and then become reinforced. So this has really changed my stance on pure mental visualization as practice. I think we need the expert coaches. All right, let's go into the last little bit on the Diamond Age. The Diamond Age was a wonderful book by Neal Stephenson, totally enjoyable to read, and I recommend all of his books. I love him as an author in the world of speculative fiction. But The Diamond Age was particularly interesting because the conceit of the book was, and I don't think this is spoiling it for anyone, is that they had developed a book, a primer, that was made for educating children. But the primer continuously adjusted based on the capabilities and needs assessment of that child. And it had all of the knowledge necessary for the training of a young person, but continuously adjusted based on the skill acquisition and needs for deliberate practice of that learner. This is not so far-fetched. Imagine that we had such a primer. Imagine each learner had individualized attention by not human, which would require amazing amounts of resources, but by a AI, by a computer that actually was gearing all of the extent knowledge in emergency medicine critical care to the individual learner. We should be working towards this. This is something we need. This is something that would just revolutionize training. But as another intuition pump, since this is a bit in the future, how could we start using the resources we have now, make this more of a reality? I'm super curious to hear what you think about all of the above. This has been Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast, saying bye-bye.